ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 2nd of May. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the estranged husband of Erin Patterson returns to the stand in her triple murder trial in regional Victoria. And emu invasion. The town's inundated with mobs of curious, thirsty visitors.
We're seeing such huge numbers of them, and a lot of them are juvenile. I feel like there's a lot more emus coming into town than what there was, say, in 2019. If we don't get those follow-up reins, they're not going to leave. They're going to keep coming into town.
It's almost time for tools down for federal political hopefuls across the country who've been spruiking their policies in the hopes of winning your vote tomorrow. Queues have formed outside many early voting centres again today as Australians choose who will sit in the next federal parliament. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and opposition leader Peter Dutton are wrapping up their campaigns by targeting marginal seats. Stephanie Smale reports.
Voters in the Brisbane seat of Moreton are bustling to the ballot box, getting their vote in early like so many other Australians this election.
Thank you.
It's one of a string of Queensland seats where experienced MPs are retiring, opening up the contest for the first time in years. In the Brisbane seat of Griffith, further north, this voter hasn't joined the queue yet. She's going to cast her ballot tomorrow, but doubts there'll be any big surprises with the result.
Hopefully not. I feel like my social media, the algorithm is very geared towards what I'm looking for.
These residents from the Dixon electorate have voted by post and say the coalition didn't get their vote this time round.
I have normally been a conservative voter for many years, but I've probably gone more towards the Labor side. I was not at all happy with the thought of going down the nuclear route. And that's one of the big things that swayed me.
I tend to be more a Labor supporter, I guess, and I don't like the whole Trump thing, so I think Dutton's following a Trump lead and that just turns me right off.
The opposition leader Peter Dutton says it's been a long campaign, but he says his party's polling is suggesting this election could be similar to 2019, when then Prime Minister Scott Morrison won.
You've got a lot of interesting contests playing on the ground where we've had a very significant effort by great candidates, and I think there'll be some big surprises on election night.
He's defended the coalition's election campaign, telling the ABC he disagrees with descriptions by some it's been the worst in Liberal history.
I mean, that's insider talk from left-wing journalists. I'm not worried about that.
Well, I can assure you it hasn't come from left-wing journalists. It's come from within your party.
Yeah, well, all I'm worried about is how we can help families, and that's what we're targeting.
And he's continued to spruik the coalition's plans to cut spending and to improve the country's economic management.
Our bottom line is that we have $40 billion less debt than Labor. So a big spending Labor Greens government means higher inflation and higher interest rates. That is the last thing mortgage holders need at the moment.
If Labor wins, Anthony Albanese would be the first Prime Minister to win back-to-back elections since 2004. Throughout the campaign, he's had to defend his government's handling of the cost of living crisis. As crunch time looms, he's sticking to the line that Labor would keep easing the financial pain if he's back in the top job.
We have inflation down to 2.4%. We have wages increasing. We have unemployment low, and we have interest rates have started to fall. Every one of the key economic indicators is improving. Under the former government, we inherited interest rates going up, inflation with a six in front of it, wages going backwards, childcare and aged care in crisis.
The campaign is wrapping up, but questions on policy are still swirling. The coalition's promise to cut 41,000 Commonwealth public service jobs is one of those, and its vows to focus on Canberra positions through natural attrition. The Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor, says the cuts won't affect regional services, but it's not clear where the major cities will see jobs go.
We'll be maintaining our regional frontline services as we always have. There'll be no change to that, but the numbers will come down with natural attrition.
Policy gaps are being discussed too. Labor's Finance Minister Katie Gallagher has been pressed on why increased welfare payments aren't on the table for Labor, despite expert advice.
I think if you go back and have a look at what we've done in 3 years compared to what the former government did in 10 years, you will see that we have been, where we've been able to afford it, we've been able to invest in those payments and pensions.
Polling places will close across the country at 6 p.m. tomorrow.
Stephanie Smale. Well, as the leaders sell their final messages, which party has the edge on the last day of the campaign? Labor is under pressure for not delivering more in its first term, while Peter Dutton is under fire for an underwhelming campaign performance. Meanwhile, the independents look set to play a decisive role in several key seats. Jacob Grieber is ABC's chief digital political correspondent at Parliament House in Canberra. I spoke to him a short time ago. Jacob, it's been a long, hard 5 weeks of this election campaign. And when you look at the final polling, in your view, has Labor won the campaign or have the coalition lost it?
I think you'd have to give it to Labor, the campaign. Very disciplined campaign. They've got a message that they've stuck to. Whether you agree with it or not is not what I'm addressing here. I'm talking about their ability to pursue their argument, whereas the coalition really has struggled pretty much from day one. They were announcing things that required a lot of explaining to the electorate when time was running short. They were saying certain things and then having to back away from them. The work from home issue leaps to mind. I think in terms of the way the campaign progressed, Peter Dutton got better as he went in terms of the message. The problem was his message then wasn't resonating as much. And I think, what do I know? We'll find out on polling day tomorrow. That's the only real outcome that matters. That's when the people actually tell us what they thought of all of this. It is my view that the campaign itself has been won by Labor and not by the opposition. And that's a comment on the nature of the campaign. Voters might see it completely different. And the polls, unfortunately for Peter Dutton, suggest that they are heading to Labor. You might have argument about the level of support between the different polls, but they're all pretty much moving in the same direction.
Just on the independents, we spoke about some of those seats, particularly tight races like Coogong and Goldstein. Are we getting more of a sense now of which of those seats will be in play tomorrow?
Those ones are still tough. All the parties are saying those are tough races. There are local individuals, characters in play that matter. There are tactics that either side have used. And so there's not a lot of bold prediction making going on in the political class about some of those seats. What those parties also know is once an independent wins a second term, they get really hard to blow out of there. Those seats tend to be lost for good.
Is there any one factor that you're looking at most closely as we enter the 11th hour of this election campaign?
Well, I guess on the night, tomorrow night itself, I'm very, very carefully watching what happens in Victoria. I think that will be an important guide as to whether Peter Dutton can climb the 20-seat mountain that he needs to get to a majority. If there isn't a very strong swing to the coalition underway in Victoria, it'll be apparent quite early in the night whether that's in any way in the realms of possibility. And then the discussion, if that doesn't happen, if the swing's really, you know, it needs to come in at 5, 6, 7% to the coalition for it to start having a chance to really take large numbers of seats off Labor in Victoria. If that doesn't happen there, there's not a lot else around the map, around the country, for the coalition to get large numbers. And everyone in the sort of political game has their lists, and there's a lot of tough seats out there. But with the polls, the sort of national polls, the two-party preferred polls, all breaking to Labor's favour, and they've all been doing it over the last 3 or 4 weeks, really since the campaign started, it's hard to see how that big swing might be underway, certainly nationally, but in Victoria to the coalition. So I think we're going to be watching a night unfold. And this is me making probably a foolish prediction, but once we get a sense of Victoria, the question's really going to be, Does Albanese have enough to form a majority? Is he just short? Or indeed, is he going to expand his majority? All those questions will be unfolded, but that's where my eyes will be.
I'll hold you to that prediction. Jacob Grebe is the ABC's chief digital political correspondent at Parliament House in Canberra. Thank you.
Good on you.
And tune in to ABC Local Radio on Saturday night for all your live election results from 6 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also stay across all the election updates via the ABC Listen app. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. US National Security Advisor Mike Waltz will leave his post in the first major shakeup of President Donald Trump's inner circle since he took office in January. President Trump says he will nominate Mr. Waltz to be the next US ambassador to the United Nations and has named Secretary of State Marco Rubio as his interim replacement. It comes just weeks after it was revealed Mr. Waltz added a journalist to a group chat on the messaging app Signal in which top officials were discussing sensitive military strikes. Gavin Coote has more.
As President Donald Trump today delivered an address at the White House, reports were swirling that he was planning to oust his national security adviser, Mike Waltz. Hours later, the first White House casualty of Trump's second term was confirmed. In a social media post, he declared Mr. Waltz will be nominated as the next US ambassador to the United Nations. The announcement took State Department spokesperson Tammy Bruce by surprise as she was holding a briefing with reporters.
The president has just written on Truth Social that Mike Waltz is going to become the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations.
Well, there you go.
No longer the national security advisor.
Fabulous.
And in addition to that, he says that in the interim, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will serve as national security advisor while continuing his strong leadership at the State Department. Do you know how long he's going to be serving in both roles?
It is clear that I just heard this from you. So that is the miracle of modern technology and the social media.
Questions have surrounded Mike Waltz's future since the Signalgate controversy, where he accidentally added the editor of a news magazine to a high-level chat group that was discussing military strikes in Yemen. Reacting to the news, Republican Senator Kevin Cramer said it was right of Mr. Waltz to step aside.
Donald Trump has a history of dismissing people rather quickly if they don't meet his expectation. On the case of Mike and Signalgate and all of that, it was a pretty big breach. It was a pretty big problem, and personally I think he owned up to it, which is noble.
In his first term, Donald Trump had four national security advisers. One of them was John Bolton.
Mike Waltz lasted 102 days. That's better than Trump's first national security advisor, Mike Flynn, who lasted 22 days. But nonetheless, it's hardly a way to conduct effective decision making in the critical foreign and defense policy field.
Mike Waltz's nomination as ambassador to the UN means he will now go through a Senate confirmation process, which John Bolton thinks will bring unwanted attention back on the Signal chat controversy.
And it's going to be painful for the administration to go through all of that yet again, maybe for several days, as people or witnesses are brought in to explain why it was so dangerous, and to have Waltz walk through why he set the group up, to ask how many other Signal chat groups he had set up. It could be very painful for Waltz and the administration.
While it's unclear how long Marco Rubio will serve as interim national security advisor, while also Secretary of State, it's the first time an official has held both positions simultaneously since Henry Kissinger in the 1970s. John Bolton questions how Mr. Rubio will be able to juggle the two roles.
The function of the national security advisor really is to be the honest broker among all the different cabinet departments and agencies like the intelligence community that have equities in national security decision-making, and to provide the basis, provide the information, the options, the pros and cons, and so on, of the different possibilities to the president for his ultimate decision. And for a cabinet secretary to hold both jobs, I think, is regarded by most as tilting the decision-making now in favor of Rubio and the State Department.
Democrats are continuing to call for the sacking of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who posted sensitive information in the Signal chat and shared it with dozens of others in a second chat, including his wife and brother. Donald Trump has maintained public confidence in Mr. Hegseth.
Gavin Coote there. Staying stateside, President Donald Trump has signed an executive order to open both US and international waters to deep sea mining, ignoring a global treaty that controls the high seas. The aim of the order is to boost US production of critical minerals, an industry currently dominated by China. But scientists and legal experts have expressed concern. Adelaide Miller reports.
Lying at the bottom of the deep sea, thousands of metres below the ocean's surface, are what's known as critical minerals. The Clarion-Clipperton Zone, a large body of water in the Pacific Ocean, is a particularly abundant area filled with copper, cobalt and nickel. And the race is on to start mining. But there's concern it'll be a breach of international law.
The US is bound by the Law of the Sea Convention. It's essentially the crucial provision about the deep sea being the common heritage of humankind.
Duncan Curry is an international environmental lawyer. He's concerned that a Canadian mining group, The Metals Company, will get a permit to mine from the US government, bypassing the International Seabed Authority who govern the deep sea.
One country cannot go there and expropriate or take the minerals and keep them for themselves. That's really very, very clear and very fundamental.
Scientists also warn there are still too many unknowns about the deep sea to begin commercial mining. Dr. Patricia Esquire is from the University of Aveiro in Portugal.
We're just starting to understand and starting to reach ecosystems that have been not been reached for decades. And we are doing it very little by little. So science needs time, and we are just trying to, so we cannot pretend to understand an ecosystem or a system that we've been studying not for a long time.
She says damage to biodiversity could be irreversible.
It's a lot of species that depend directly or indirectly on the nodules to live, because they live on top, underneath, or around the nodules. So if you take out the nodules, the ecosystem is gone. The community, the whole living community is gone, or it will change.
32 countries have called for a moratorium, including France, the UK, and many Pacific Island nations. They're seeking a precautionary ban until more is understood about the deep sea. But Australia is not one of those. Phil McCabe is an ocean campaigner for the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition in New Zealand. He has been one of the key figures pushing for a moratorium over the last 5 years and says he's completely bewildered as to why Australia hasn't shown its support.
There's no benefit to Australia from deep sea mining going ahead in international waters. There's no commercial interest from Australian entities. If anything, opening up the deep sea and minerals that exist there could negatively impact Australia's economy. The vast majority of Australia's strategic partners do support a moratorium. So we just really don't understand why Australia is sitting on their hands on this issue.
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade told the ABC that Australia doesn't condone deep sea mining beyond national jurisdiction without the regulatory framework currently being negotiated by the ISA. But it said the announcement from the metals company is a matter for the company and the US government.
Adelaide Miller. The estranged husband of accused mushroom triple murderer Erin Patterson is giving evidence in court for a second day. Ms. Patterson is accused of killing her ex-husband's parents and aunt, who died after she served them a beef Wellington lunch containing poisonous death cap mushrooms in 2023. Reporter Alexandra Alvaro is at the Latrobe Valley Magistrates Court in Morwell, Victoria, where the trial is taking place.
We've been taken back to Erin Patterson's hospital trip the couple of days after the mushroom lunch that she'd organised for her ex-husband's family. Now, the court had previously heard that she went to hospital with gastrointestinal symptoms and that she later self-discharged, causing alarm amongst hospital staff because they were worried that she'd consumed that mushroom lunch that had, of course, made four other guests pretty ill by that point. Erin had told them that she'd like to leave the hospital, but today Simon Patterson, it was put to him that Erin did in fact have an aversion towards hospitals, and he confirmed that yes, indeed, she hated hospitals. The court had also previously heard that Erin initially refused to take her children to hospital, the concern amongst hospital staff being that they'd eaten the leftovers of that meal, Erin telling them that she didn't want to scare the kids. Now, it was put to Mr. Patterson today that the kids did also have an aversion to hospital, that they'd had prior bad experiences in hospital, and he confirmed that that was true. Now, Erin Patterson has pleaded not guilty to all the charges against her. She maintains that she did not deliberately poison her guests. Her defence admitting that while she did forage for mushrooms, she didn't seek out death cat mushrooms. He was even emotional just a few moments ago. He was, the court was shown vision of a backyard science experiment that was being conducted. His late father Don was in the video. His son was also in the video. Once that video was shown, he was seen wiping away tears. He also became emotional yesterday when he described when he first visited his father in hospital after the mushroom poisoning. He said he was kind of keeled over. He was finding it difficult to speak and he could tell that he was ill. And another time he became emotional was when he was asked about Erin Patterson's relationship with his own parents, saying that she had an affinity with his father, that they enjoyed, they had both had a thirst for knowledge, and that she enjoyed his gentle nature.
That's Alexandra Alvaro reporting from Morwell, Victoria. Well, don't be alarmed if you see some tall strangers having a sticky beak in town. Large mobs of emus have been causing havoc in urban areas of New South Wales in recent weeks. Wildlife experts say the iconic birds are thirsty and seeking water in dry conditions. Experts predict that more birds will come out in droves in other states as well. Kathleen O'Connor has more.
In Broken Hill in far western New South Wales, an unusual phenomenon has descended on the town. Mobs of emus have been roaming the streets. The native birds can be seen casually roaming around on nature strips and on local roads.
We're seeing such huge numbers of them, and a lot of them are juvenile.
Stephanie Grieve is a local wildlife rescuer and says the animals are seeking refuge in water due to drought conditions.
I joined at the tail end of the last drought. So, you know, in my opinion, I feel like there's a lot more emus coming into town than what there was, say, in 2019. We've had a really good season, so, you know, just like everything is bred right up, and that's where all the bigger numbers are coming from.
The last time the town saw numbers like these was 6 years ago. Stephanie Grieve says she's been inundated with calls for help from locals who are coming face to face with as many as 20 emus at a time. The Bureau of Meteorology says low rainfall is likely to persist through the winter months, and not just in New South Wales. Caitlin Minney is a climatologist.
A likely drier than average start to that season for not just Broken Hill and surrounding regions, but actually for much of Australia.
National Parks and Wildlife Service Ranger Emma McLean says it's not uncommon, and emus know how to cope with Australia's infamous hot and dry climate.
The animals are quite used to changeable conditions, and so it's really quite handy for animals that are able to move about like emus. We've got open woodlands and grasslands and semi-arid scrublands. Those different environments, those different habitats actually provide a different kind of cover and different food. So as one may dry up or be exhausted, the animals will move around to follow that. They're just curious creatures, so they are going to follow the food and follow the water.
It's not the first time regional residents have struggled with an emu inundation. Back in the 1930s, West Australian farmers turned to machine guns to repel the birds from their crops.
These are some of the unfortunate farmers whose wheat crops have been trampled down by hordes of emus. But they're hopeful of getting rid of the pest at last.
These days, Emma McLean says, thankfully, there's been a very different response.
Hopefully we're not inundated. We don't have a repeat of the 1930s emu wars. But, you know, they really are gentle creatures, and they're just trying to do their best.
Local wildlife rescuer Stephanie Grieve says without more rainfall, there will only be increased sightings in more locations.
If we don't get those follow-up rains, they're not going to leave. They're going to keep coming into town. It's not just going to be, you know, more emus coming in. We're going to see more kangaroos coming in too.
She's urging locals to drive slowly and not to feed them.
Just slow down. Just give them time to work out what they're doing. Give them some respect and support that, you know, they really need. Because ideally, you know, looking at them, the emus on the Australian coat of arms. So, you know, they are a very special animal to the Australian public, I feel. So, you know, I think that if people just, you know, give them their space, Don't encourage them in with food. That's the main thing. I think that we are very, very lucky to be able to experience having emus walking up our main street, for example. You know, a lot of our city companions, you know, through wires, they rarely see an emu full stop, let alone, you know, us having a lot of calls coming through for help for emus. So, you know, they're in a bit of awe that, you know, we get to experience that.
Wildlife rescuer Stephanie Grieve, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The polls tell us Anthony Albanese is going to win. But the ABC's election analyst, Anthony Green, who's just about to retire, is not willing to call it yet. So today, Anthony Green's guide to the election. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.